Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest installment of Mentality Monsters. We're coming at you in this third full week of January on the tail of what was certainly the best four-pack of NFL games we have ever seen in a single weekend.
Ever?
Just yes.
Wow.
And while recency bias can factor into a lot, I will state my case. Yesterday, because this is a Monday, I was watching the games with actually my future in-law, who's into football, my fiance, and the day kicked off with Matthew Stafford seeking his first ever divisional playoff win against Tom Brady, who is seeking his 10th consecutive one. And Matthew Stafford came out on fire. The Rams established a 27-3 lead. They did their very best after establishing that 27-3 lead to be another footnote in one of Tom Brady's most epic performances. Four fumbles, a 47-yard kickoff that fell short of the goalpost, and a snap that went over the quarterback's head. All led to the ability for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers to tie the game at 27 all on a 4th-and-1 run by Leonard Fournette, which had to have left that stadium in absolute pandemonium when that happened. That's when Matthew Stafford found my NFL MVP, Cooper Kupp, twice, once for 20 and once for over 40 yards. In 1999, Tom Peters wrote a book called The Circle of Innovation, built on the premise that you can't shrink your way to greatness. And while the Rams tried their very best, the one way that they didn't, Von Miller trading for him and getting Matthew Stafford, those two were the difference for the Rams against the Buccaneers. Tom Brady has a tendency to shrink the greatness of whoever he does go against. And he did that to every member of the Rams coaching staff, every member of the Rams defense. Jalen Ramsey, he got beat on a deep ball late. Everybody except Von Miller was consistently there. He was consistently there, and the gamble for Matthew Stafford paid off as well. And yet another testament to how crazy this weekend was, Bills Chiefs ended with a final score of 42-36. And it was 23-21 going into the fourth. That is nuts. Game was on the line. Buffalo was down 9. Josh Allen hit Gabriel Davis for 75 yards, and that was just the start. That was the appetizer. After that, Kansas City settled for a field goal after Tyreek Hill had a 46-yard punt return, which put them up by 4, to which Josh Allen responded with a 17-play, 75-yard drive, where he converted 2 third downs, 2 fourth downs, and a 2-point conversion to take the lead with a minute 35 left. That's when Mahomes responded to Tyreek Hill, who I'm stunned did not get a penalty for taunting, as he went 60-plus yards. That only took 33 seconds of total time for the Chiefs to retake the lead. And with 1:02 left, the Bills got the ball back, and Josh Allen would eventually hit Gabriel Davis for his 4th touchdown of the day with 13 seconds remaining. And we all know what happened from there. Chiefs somehow, some way, were able to get 2 plays to sneak into field goal range and kick an unbelievable, I think it was 47 or 48-yard game-tying field goal to send into overtime. All told, this weekend saw a team that surrendered 9 sacks in the Cincinnati Bengals win on Saturday night, a team that did not score a touchdown on offense win on Saturday night, the San Francisco 49ers, a team that fumbled 4 times win on Sunday, capped by a team that won despite trailing with 13 seconds remaining. It was the first time ever in playoff history that all four games were decided on the final play or in overtime. And if you took that same number, four games in one postseason, and extrapolated it over an entire postseason, much less one weekend, that would be more than there has ever been in a single postseason in NFL history. 3.8 points was the lowest margin of victory on average for a single weekend in playoff history, and the total margin of victory across all four games was 15 points. Saturday saw the longest game-winning field goal as time expired in league history by Evan McPherson of the Bengals. 1988 was the last time the Bengals appeared in a title game, which coincidentally was also the last time a quarterback who had been sacked as many times as Burrow had won a postseason game. And the time before that, the quarterback that had been sacked the most times to ever win a playoff game was Len Dawson in the 1966 AFL Championship to beat the Buffalo Bills. Speaking of the Buffalo Bills, who had a really rough weekend, the Niners produced the second latest game tying or winning special teams touchdown in NFL postseason history since the Music City Miracle against the 1999 Bills. These 248 minutes of football represent an outstanding reminder of why we created this podcast. To sit with these incredible results, these incredible images and incredible accomplishments and personalities, and dissect what we have just seen. It was the perfect day to find, nay, to create the storylines as we saw them. So perhaps we can live a little better. Perhaps we can generate a little more success and a little more joy in our daily lives. Personally, I was enjoying all those things yesterday. That was a feast for me. My team was sitting at home, and I'm glad they were, because I don't know if I could have handled being on the losing end of any one of those absurd results from this weekend.
It was very painful for me to watch the Bengals win the way they did, given that they're basically the Browns of last year, albeit a lot more successful.
Yes, a lot more successful.
I thought the games were unbelievable as well. The Bills and Chiefs game is going to go down as the best of all of them.
Like, I think classic. So as well.
You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of remember that game where the Packers played the Cardinals in the year that the Cardinals went to the Super Bowl, and it was just a wild shootout. Kurt Warner, Aaron Rodgers, and it ended on a Carlos Dansby forced fumble, defensive touchdown in overtime. It reminded me a lot of that game, just like insane plays left and right.
A game that was.
Insane quarterback play.
We saw the full display. You're talking about insane quarterback play of the next generation of quarterbacking. I mean, full respect to what Peyton Manning did for the game from a line of scrimmage pre-adjustment standpoint, and obviously Brady's longevity, but we weren't talking about arm angles and the ability to like hurdle defenders on top of being able to do all that, which is what we saw yesterday.
The way that both Mahomes and Allen can throw is baffling. And you're right. Like, before they showed up, no one ever talked about arm angles or release points or, you know, throwing with your left hand or no look passes.
Yeah.
The thing that amazes me is Josh Allen to me is still a Cam Newton that can throw. And I feel like everyone is forgetting like what happened to Cam Newton over time with all those hits and hurdles and everything that he was like. Allen was lowering his shoulder into guys. One Kansas City player that he actually like knocked the wind out of.
Yeah,
which has got to be really embarrassing for a defensive player. But
I thought that same thing when I saw him on his back. I was like, dude, you want to like have the cart come out because you really want to be injured right now. Like, you don't want to just have gotten steamrolled.
Like by a 6'5" Nebraskan, or wherever he's from, North Dakotan, I think. I don't know. I mean, Josh Allen is unbelievable to me. I am, as with a lot of people say, like you get floored by the fact that he actually improved the way he did. And the thing that's wild to me is the way that the Bills built around him seemed to me at first glance like a very poor way to build a team around someone like Josh Allen. Cause you would think that like typically you get a big guy with a rocket arm that can launch it anywhere. You get big bodied receivers that have large catch radiuses that can catch balls that are not perfectly accurate. The Bills did the exact opposite. They got guys like Beasley and Diggs and John Brown a couple of years ago, who are all smaller receivers that are precise route runners and that require accurate throws in stride to make plays. And well, it worked out.
I think that having that personnel also demands that you keep a smaller, faster defense on the field, which makes it harder to defend the Josh Allen when he's running.
That is a great point as well.
Yeah.
But even still, I mean, the fact that if Josh Allen wasn't making those successful throws to those smaller receivers that require more accuracy, absolutely. if he didn't develop his game to that point where he could do that, which he couldn't do his first couple of years.
Yep, 52% completion percentage his rookie year, 59 his second year, then jumped up to 69 his third year.
Yeah, that's insane. And if he wasn't able to do that, then defenses would lock in. I mean, you look at the Browns. I mean, this year is a bad example, but the Browns love to run the ball. Defenses just stop the run, and the Browns can't do anything because everyone knows what's coming. You know, look at Lamar Jackson, too. I mean, Lamar Jackson this year, I think, was really exposed because, yes, he was hurt on and off, but even when he's in these games, like, he wasn't impressive enough as a passer, I think, to really threaten you in any other way through the air. And you could blame like Greg Roman and their lack of receivers, but after a certain point, if Lamar Jackson is going to be this transcendent talent that revolutionizes the game, then does he really need amazing receivers to prop him up? I mean, look at Brady. He almost beat the Rams with fourth stringers.
He did. And I think that was one of his best performances. You can't ask for more outside of winning a title than to defend it the way they did and really go out on their shields, despite all the turmoil that team faced. But yeah, to keep it central to the conversation about, you know, Mahomes and Allen, I think the thing that I was sitting with after the game yesterday was the way the Chiefs were able to navigate the late game situation and the onslaught from the Bills. But Andy Reid was the guy who couldn't do that for 18 years. 18 years. And then he can. And yes, part of that's due to Mahomes. But I thought, if you're a Bills fan, you got to realize the only thing that separates you from them is the experience. Like, Andy Reid was the guy who he couldn't manage the clock. He always choked when trying to get to a championship game for 18 freaking years. And then he got Mahomes, and they figured it out.
The key thing about the Chiefs, though, is also Kelce and Tyreek Hill. Like,
yeah,
Mahomes being able to throw to them. Tyreek Hill, he's like what OBJ was when OBJ first showed up. He takes a small slant or a crossing pattern to the house 75 yards because he's so fast.
Yeah, it's funny to listen to the announcers after he does that, too. It's like, oh, the one thing you can't let him do. It's like, come on, man. Like, you can't let him do anything. But he's going to fit, like, okay.
His nickname is Cheetah.
Right. Which is why it's understandable the Bills played the defense that they did at the end of the game, because they just threw a 75-yard TD over the top of everybody to Gabriel Davis. They saw it earlier in the day when Mike Evans ran by Jalen Ramsey for 55 with, you know, when the defense gets compact and tries to defend the sticks or the field goal, like, they have to respect that this man could run by you and catch an 80-yard touchdown.
See, I think what they did was the wrong play. I think they had one too many rusher, and they let Travis, like, you, I understand defending deep, but you can't let Travis Kelce break free at the line of scrimmage alone. Like, there are two guys you need to defend on the Chiefs in those situations. It's Tyreek Hill or Travis Kelce. And to leave him open because you're so afraid of a touchdown over the top that you're going to give up enough yardage for a field goal underneath is asinine. I don't know what you're thinking.
I don't think the Bills did anything wrong except not kick it off inbounds to waste clock. And that's not like a – only Bill Belichick would think of that. That's like an obvious thing that you really needed to do.
Yeah. But even the long touchdowns that the Chiefs had were not over-the-top touchdowns.
No, you're right. I'm saying it's right. It is easy to say after the fact that they can't, you know, have defended it the way they did, because if they really did sit on everything, it would have been possible for Tyreek Hill to run, just blow by everybody over the top.
I don't know, man. I think that it's far more of a gamble for the offense to try to Hail Mary it into the end zone or to try to Hail Mary it down the field 40, 50 yards. Because if you play it right on defense and you take the right angle, you leave two safeties up deep, you can still play that pass much more easily than you can play a wide open underneath pass to Travis Kelce, who has a head of steam, has momentum, and now is able to take the tackler, who is a smaller guy, because you have to put smaller guys out there to defend against a deep pass, smaller guy on him. Now he can truck him for like five extra yards and get you in the field goal range that you need.
Well, I'll say too that I don't know if you heard after the game, Mahomes was talking to Kelce or talking about that play with Kelce, and they improved it. Kelce just really? Told him before the play, he goes, I'm just going to run where they're not.
Unbelievable.
And then he said, because he's like, okay, here's what the coverage was in the last play. So if they do it again, I'm just going to go where the space is. And then they show the broadcast play where Mahomes, his call at the line was, he says, Travis, do it. Do it.
Unbelievable. And, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, he basically said, like, okay, this is the zone coverage. You're right, they would have to play man, which in that case, do it just on him. You can't do that against Tyreek Hill. You can't do that.
I think you let anyone other than those two guys beat you.
I do agree with that.
I guarantee you, if it was Belichick in that moment, he would double up Kelce, double up Tyreek, and just one-on-one with all the other receivers and dare Mahomes to throw it to someone else. Because 13 seconds left, 13 seconds left, like, come on, someone else beat me. I mean, the Bills did it perfectly. The Bills had Gabriel. I mean, Gabriel played a monster game, and it wasn't just like, he happened to be wide open all the time. He like had the game of his life.
Yeah, and he broke people's ankles. Sitting people down.
I actually think that, like, in terms of impressiveness, I think what Allen did last night was more impressive than what Mahomes did.
Yeah.
Because we talked about this on another episode, but to me, what Kansas City does is still, it's amazing, but it's still boring. Like, you know, Tyreek Hill runs across the field, Kelce runs up the field, and Mahomes picks the poison. And if neither of them are open, he either goes underneath to a running back or runs it, scrambles it for like 5 to 7 yards. Allen and the Bills, I feel like, really had to fight for it, which is a testament to how good a team Kansas City is. Yep. And it's such a shame that they lost.
The game, a couple things. I think that the Bills elevated the Chiefs to a level that they didn't know they had. The Chiefs were ready for it. And it reminded me of Arturo Gatti against Mickey Ward, where there's a famous picture of them after the fight in the same hospital room together, like laughing about it. And I was like, that's what just happened. They murdered each other. Like, they would be locked in an eternal. The game would still be going on if there was no,
there's no
like
overtime.
Sudden death overtime. Like, they would just be like, okay, well, you know, first team that doesn't score, like, no, they would still be going.
Yeah. The defense has got so tired, and they just like were letting everything. Any
yeah, it was like Paul Bunyan wrestling the ox. And,
yeah. like, yeah, I felt bad for the Bills. It sucks when you do everything right, and then you relax in the last moments and you end up letting it slip away. I think they were, their final actions in those last 15, 20 seconds were like, it was just all motivated by fear. You've talked about before, like the prevent defense allows the exact result that you want to prevent, because you're focusing so hard on stopping the one thing you don't want to stop that like you end up manifesting it. And I think that that's exactly what happened with the Bills. They were, in my mind, they created that demon that they were trying to keep bottled in because they were too afraid to attack it.
Yeah, I have a tough time just being critical of them. Like, it was obviously the wrong thing to do, but man, like every other play, they had it right.
Even the kick into the back of the end zone, the last kick, that was a decision made of fear. Like, you're kicking it out of the end zone because you don't want their returner to potentially return the kick.
I mean, there's ways around that. You could squib it,
or like I understand
what, man, what, like anything but that.
What I'm saying is like that, like all of that, every single one of those actions was it was indicative of like you said, inexperienced, the moment being a little bit too big for them, and being too afraid of what Patrick Mahomes can do. Like, Mahomes is superhuman, but he's not that superhuman. And like, I think they could have stopped him if they played it a little more intelligently, or if they weren't motivated by fear the way they were.
You know, as you said, in retrospect, they played it wrong. It's hard, man. It's hard to, in those moments, Mahomes is, he really is that good. And the combination of him and Andy Reid, I mean, you saw it firsthand last year with the Browns. Like, they went for it on 4th and 2 and with a backup quarterback, and they threw it. You just don't know what Andy Reid's got up his sleeve, man. He's a brilliant, you know, brilliant designer of plays. And they came up against the more experienced team. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. The thing that, this is the final thing I'll say about it. The reason I'm so disappointed and so critical is because the Bills did the exact thing you have to do to beat the Chiefs in Arrowhead in the playoffs. They came out and they were aggressive and they attacked. And that mindset is what allowed them to keep punching back over and over again.
Yep.
And then in the final moments where you have the opportunity to close it out, continue to use that mentality to your advantage, you turtle up and you kind of back away from it, you know? And that to me was the most disappointing. It's like the opposite happens with the Browns all the time, where the Browns will come out punching really hard and they'll build up like a 30-point lead. And then they get into this mode where they're like, all right, let's just run it out and we'll pray that the clock runs out before the other team can score enough points to come back. And so they have that. Yeah, it's really frustrating. They get into that mindset where they're just trying to bleed the clock. And then what happens is when the team comes back and it's a one score game, or they go up by 3 points, and now all of a sudden the entire second half, you've had your team just relaxed and waiting for the clock to hit zero. All of a sudden in the fourth quarter on the last drive, you're like, hey guys, we need to go and be aggressive again. And how can you ask your team that you've told effectively to take the foot off the pedal for 30 minutes to go and switch it and be like, hey, we got to be animals again, like we were in the first quarter. I think that mindset and mentality, like the approach that you take to it and the way you think about it impacts your decision-making. And then that impacts the result. Like, if you're going to put everyone 30 yards back, that says something to the Chiefs, but it also says something to the Bills and all of the defenders that are on the field. Like, hey, we are very afraid of what could potentially happen back here, so much so that we're going to ignore what's happening right in front of us.
And yet every team doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. It's so stupid. It is so stupid. I, for the life of me, can't understand it.
Yeah, it's a big reason why in games that they have in hand, Belichick still goes. It's like, yeah, they'll win games 57-13. You're like, what are they doing? It's like that. They're doing what you just outlined, just staying with the plan. That's it.
I mean, Rams did the same exact thing that I just described that the Browns did.
Oh, like, man, I'll tell you what, though. McVay coached the game as if he still had Goff.
Yeah, I remember you making that point.
Like, you go out and you tell us he's the problem. You go out and you fix the problem. You get this other guy. But then you manage the game like you're afraid of what your quarterback might do. You know, the way he managed that game was criminal. And the Bucs could not defend the Rams passing game.
Yeah, why would you ever run it?
Yeah. Exactly. Their strength is run defense. It's hilariously imbalanced. The Bucs have like the greatest run defense in history and like one of the worst pass defenses in the league, which, okay, because they're winning every game. Mostly, you know, Brady put up more than 30 points like 13 times this year. You're going to give up some passing yards. So some of that is skewed. But they're a lot better defending the run than they are. Like, why would you do that? It makes no sense. McVay was the worst goat of the weekend.
He seems like a massive control freak.
Yeah.
Like, he just needs everything to go exactly how it's planned, and he doesn't want anything that could potentially deviate from that plan.
Yeah, and what we're talking about coaches, we talked about obviously Reed, and we're you know hitting on McVay now. I did a lot of reflecting on what makes a great coach, particularly for teams as well as individuals, and I was really enjoying watching that play out or not play out this weekend. I believe there's four elements to a world-class coach. The first of which is recognition of a person's ability with respect to the results. So when a coach arrives at a team, can he look the players in the eye and say, you are performing at the level that your ability allows you to? Are you playing above that? If so, what things have led to you doing that? And can you continue to do that? If not, can you be honest with them and say, you're not playing up to your ability and here's why? And people respect the honesty. So I think having that individualized voice when a coach comes into a team where he's able to look at each of the players and give an honest assessment is an immediate indication that, okay, this person can be honest with me, he can see clearly, and he can challenge me in the right ways. When you go blanket message with you all can do better, or last year was trash, or I think you guys are all the greatest and you can achieve the greatest, maybe some of them don't believe that. So that message has a chance to miss a lot of folks. And you see that with a lot of coaches who are serially positive, where I think a coach like Andy Reid has the ability, as he did this season, perhaps as well as he ever did, look at what his players were doing in the middle of the season and say, look, I know you've got it in your locker to achieve X. Here's what needs to be adjusted right now in this moment. And because he can do that from the outset, he can do it on the fly and make those proper adjustments.
That honesty needs to be grounded in reality as well. You can't go to, you know, like a backup quarterback and say you're going to be Tom Brady in 3 years if you try really hard. You can if the guy's capable of doing it, but you also have to manage, you know, understanding who that person is. And that's part of the power of what you're saying about those types of coaches.
We be what we do, and we only do our habits. Mm-hmm. So if you look at a backup quarterback who goes out and parties in the off season and doesn't study tape, you tell me it could be Tom Brady. Not even he believes that. because in order to be the person who's completely composed in every game situation and puts the fear of God in other teams and challenges his teammates, you've got to be somebody who takes care of your body. You've also got to be somebody who shows up on time, be somebody who studies. And so like those, you're missing three or four sub identities to the overall identity of a Tom Brady.
This must be why so many Patriot players do really well in the Patriots.
It is.
And then flop on other teams.
Yep.
It's likely that Belichick is finding the few things that the players are maximally capable of or maximally good at, and then helping them achieve those things and then putting them in the positions to use those skills in a way that benefits the team overall.
I would agree with that. Belichick has proven to be extraordinarily good at that with, you know, we'll say complementary pieces of the team that go to other teams, and you know, they're not able to produce what they did in New England.
Shanahan is like that too.
Totally agree. Yes.
Shanahan is like the modern version of Belichick in that way. Like you, a lot of people talk about his system being really kind to running backs and like, oh, you could pump out 1,000-yard running back with like any person back there. But I think it's way more than that. I think they're finding guys that they know will fit the system and that have the skills that are necessary to enable the system to amplify their results in a way that makes it seem like any running back could plug in, but not any. Like, I don't think Trent Richardson would be able to do well in a Shanahan system because he had no vision, you know, like you can't just put anyone in there.
What I think that Shanahan does well, in my viewpoint, is he's able to get the best out of players by ensuring that the opponent has to think more than you. You just need to act. It's like Deebo Samuel's in the backfield. Trent Williams goes in motion. It's like, oh, we don't even know if this is a pass or a run. Is it going to be to the side that lineman's motioning? And then you'll notice very frequently teams that are able to stop the 49ers. The 49ers can shift momentum like no other team because they'll overreact and he'll just take advantage of that. So the 49ers players are not thinking when they're just doing.
Shanahan, while he was on the Browns, Joe Thomas explained that when you're executing his plays, the runs look like passes and the passes look like runs. It's completely indistinguishable one from the other, which makes it hard on a defense to figure out what's actually going on. And by the time they do figure out what's going on, you have a guy wide open or a running lane open up and boom, the player's in there. That's a great point that you made. I agree with that wholeheartedly, that the other team is thinking way more than Shanahan's offense is.
Second element to a great coach, in my opinion, is mutual recognition of the mood. So this is more of a softer emotional side that's related to number one, and it's different. This is part of Ted Lasso's message, right? When Ted Lasso in the show arrives in another country, in another sport, he's initially able to get a boost out of the team by being ridiculously positive and incessantly positive. And we see this with like interim managers or interim coaches that come in, they get a little bit of a lift. But until Lasso acknowledged his own and his players' frustrations and demons, that the team made no real progress. So you must be able to, in my opinion, be someone who can recognize the mood, both of the individual players as well as the locker room, before injecting your own mood and your own viewpoints.
When you have the ability to sense that mood and understand like what is motivating players and what they think and believe, then you can cater your message to that specific mood or that specific moment, and you deliver what the moment needs. And the reason the endless positivity doesn't work is because it's similar to what you said earlier, like with the a player not believing that he could accomplish something if the message is too vague. Well, if your message is always the same and you're trying to jam a square peg into a round hole, you're not going to actually reach whoever you're coaching.
Yeah, what I find the function of positivity to be is that it will make you allergic to the things that don't align with it. So when you say, I'm a really fit individual, I'm a healthy person, et cetera, and you go into a locker room, you say, this is how we're going to play as a team. But then you don't reinforce those in practice, that lack of alignment, or you have other habits, maybe outside of the practice, that don't align with, you know, Belichick's detail-oriented every way. He never slips up with the media. He wears the same clothes every day, and he parks in the same space. Like, so he can look players in the eye and say, do X, because he lives it. So when you are casting the message of positivity, it can be good to attract some of those things that don't align with it. Like, okay, yeah, these are the things I'm currently doing or we're doing as a team that don't align with the vision. That's perfectly fine. And we see this develop with teams successfully. Like the Bills are a great example. McDermott came in and they've consistently upgraded their attitude, their standard each year, which is why I'm okay with how they treated the end of the game, because you can't prepare for that. I mean, Andy Reid's more experienced at it. He had 18 at-bats before he was able to settle into the guy who manages the clock beautifully in the postseason. So the Bills have taken massive strides, you know, year over year. And I think McDermott was able to really leverage the mood of the team after losing in the championship game last year and use that as a linchpin for why the Bills players needed to do the things they needed to do this offseason to improve.
There was a study done many years ago on prisoners of war, and specifically looking at who survives these POW camps. And they bucketed people into three categories, effectively broke down into the optimist, the realist, and the pessimist. So the pessimists die like almost immediately, because they're so negative about the situation. They're just like, this is hopeless. There's nothing we can do. They're usually the first ones to go. The optimists live a little longer, but they end up dying because they are so optimistic that eventually that optimism breaks them. Because when you're that optimistic and things never turn your way, especially in a negative situation, you're broken by the reality that things are unlikely to get better, and then you lose hope to continue on. The highest rate of survival was in the group of what they called realists, which are people that were optimistic about their ability to survive and had strong motivations and desires to survive, and acknowledged that it was likely and a possibility that they would not. So they looked at that death in the face and said, okay, I know you're there. I know you're looming. I know it's a possibility that you'll get me, but I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure you don't. And while I have that ability, I'm going to be as optimistic and positive as possible about it, while knowing that this is an outcome that is something I'd like to avoid, but is a reality. And I think that's similar to what you just stated, like a coach understanding the mood of the team. Like, you have to, you can't just ignore that specter. You know, you have to acknowledge it, and you have to buy into the reality that it's possible that you lose that game against the Chiefs, but you're going to do everything in your arsenal. You're going to use every weapon you have. You're going to do everything that you possibly can to win. And the Bills got close by doing that. I mean,
yeah, George St. Pierre used to talk about why he ultimately retired from MMA, and it was because he wasn't comfortable anymore confronting the reality that he could die in there.
Yeah.
He won more fights than he wasn't going to die. He wasn't first one. Nobody has, really, at that professional level. I'm sure amateur somewhere. He was also a grappler, so he didn't really take a lot of shots to the head, but he was like, look, it's possible that I'll get killed. And Yeah, and he said to this exact point about the prisoners of war, one time he was ridiculously certain he was going to win. That was when he lost. Which, it works differently for different fighters, obviously, but, you know, he let that creep to the point where I think he took for granted, you know, what he needed to do in training camp and to prepare himself. But like you said, he was down with the reality that, you know, this endeavor could, he could leave it all in there. So that's a powerful, parallel. And if anything happened to the Bills yesterday, I think it was that they just lost that. They thought they won.
Yeah.
Like they had it. They had it the whole time. They were like, yep, no problem. We know Mahomes is going to score. You know, I'll bet if there was 40 seconds, they would have played it exactly like you suggested. Because that's how they played the whole game.
Mm-hmm.
They were like 13. It was less of about fear and more of, well, we just don't think you could do it.
Yeah.
We're good. This game's over. Yeah. And which brings me to the, you know, point number three is mutuality of purpose. So if the purpose of everything that you do as a coach is clear, the team will be willing to employ means and to do things they otherwise wouldn't to achieve the goal. And we see this, you mentioned Shanahan, Debo Samuel's a wide receiver. It's like, hey, dude, run up the gut, will you?
Yeah.
You good with that? You know, wide receivers blocking. And this is important because the coach can also has a great opportunity to show the players that he is also willing to do that. He's also willing to change the way he does things to serve the purpose. Tom Coughlin, great example. He was military-like when he came in to the team. 3 years, didn't quite get the results. Again, with respect to the players' abilities and the results. So that first part, right? Everybody in the building believed they could do more. And it's like, well, of these things, who needs to change? Buddy, that's you. And to his credit, he did it. He evolved his approach from an emotional standpoint, from a scheme standpoint. And I think that's the third pillar of having a fantastic coach.
This is why I believe coaches like Belichick, Phil Jackson, Greg Popovich.
Yep.
This is why they infuse outside elements into what they ask the players to do day in and day out. Because the mutuality of purpose in sports is straightforward. Go and win the championship. Work together and overcome all the obstacles and raise the trophy at the end of the year. That motivating factor is interesting to me because its power goes away once you achieve it. So how do you, as a team, win a championship and then stay hungry enough to win another one, knowing that you already won one and knowing that you can't get the same amount of motivation out of that carrot that you've been chasing for so many years? And a lot of teams talk about this where it's harder to win a second championship because of that fact that I just described, like the motivation is not the same. The pure desire to acquire it is not the same, but also every other team wants to take you down. So you're getting the best of every other team you face. And so Phil Jackson used to give his players, he was known as like a hippie, used to give his players like curated books for each individual that helped them understand who they were. And they were instructed to read these books during the off season. And then they discussed them as a team afterward, but he challenged the players to find additional purpose and find ways to understand themselves better so they could perform better on the court. Popovich does this with like social issues and expanding his players' horizons and broadening their perspective so that they understand just how special it is that they play a game and can influence so many lives by playing a game. Belichick, I think this is why he emphasizes the whole do your job thing. Because when you emphasize doing your job, you emphasize the process. What you do is you focus on how you execute. And so you execute everything perfectly every single time, and you increase the opportunities that you will be successful in each scenario. Because if you execute perfectly, there's a higher likelihood that you will be successful at each at bat. And so that's why the Patriots always have these moments where it feels like everything turns for them all of a sudden. It's because they execute perfectly in every single moment. And because they're doing that, when it just so happens that the opportunity arises that they can benefit from that perfect execution, they do. I also think this is why, like, infusing this purpose into their every action goes beyond football. And that's why he teaches them about the history of the game and all this stuff. And I think the final thing is that emphasizing that makes every player feel important. Like, that's why Julian Edelman is as much of a household name as Matthew Slater. It's like, because Edelman does his job perfectly and Slater does his job perfectly, and they both contribute in their perfect way to the team, and they both have purpose that goes beyond just winning a Super Bowl. It's about pride now. It's about, like, doing your job in the most efficient, perfect, excellent way so that you can help the team win. And if there's a moment where your effort really makes a difference, then you have a higher chance of making that difference when that moment arises.
You know, I think this could be broken down even further, because the championship is the equivalent of whatever grand goal we have in life. Let's say you want to climb Everest, but you're a sedentary person. Until you identify as someone who exercises every day, you execute on those habits, and then you identify as someone who also has the right fueling regimen and fuels their bodies in the right ways, and then also someone who can do that for an extended period of time. There's three layers to it, and achieving each one has its own reward. And so these extraordinary coaches are able to draw the attention away from the grand reward to say, look, if you do this behavior in practice every single day, you will get this outcome no matter what. It's safe. It's completely in your control. Doesn't even involve the opponent. And then they stack them. Like Belichick, there's an insane statistic about how little players fumble on the Patriots, and then they go elsewhere and they fumble. Antonio Conte, he went to Tottenham in a London-based soccer club, and he banned ketchup and mayo from the team facility.
Why?
And people were like, what is he doing? And he basically said, no condiments here. Like, no desserts, none of that. And the team is more detail-oriented now. Like, they won a game they were losing in the 94th minute, 2-1, 3-2 the other day. They just have a little bit extra on it now that they're like, okay. And he's able to do that because I think he does the first three extraordinarily well. He can look a person in the eye and give them a respectful assessment of their performance. He can recognize how they're feeling, and he can also establish, okay, here's the reason why I'm asking you to stop eating this way. Because, like you said, with Popovich was a great example. Like, you only get one shot at this whole career thing, particularly in athletics. And if you want to be extraordinary and make a huge difference, you can cut this out for a couple of years. And so it touches that personal element as well when you're making an extraordinarily difficult ask of the players. And I think the final piece is mutuality of values. And Gary Vee talks about this, and from an employment perspective, always as a manager being keen to, when your employees, what they care about changes. Maybe when you're in your 20s, late 20s, you care about money. And then that switches to more time with your family when you're in your 30s. You know, what are the players' value? And so, you know, the ability to accommodate them. We hear the term players coach thrown out a lot. You know, okay, they took the team out bowling during training camp. It's like, well, do they care about that? Well, what does that mean for, you know, for the players individually? Last year, Logan Ryan, the Giants team doctor, was able to like diagnose his wife with something that would have killed her if she didn't get it removed before she, like, as she was giving birth. And like, based on her symptoms, he was on the phone with the doctor and he was like, all right, you guys need to go to the hospital, like not come home on the team plane. So look, anybody would appreciate that, obviously, but it's the broader point that he was even willing to take a call to talk about something that was outside the purview of the team. And, you know, he was able to get that player, you know, more endeared to the organization, to the operation, because of what he did and what they did for, you know, him on a personal level. So those four things put together, I think, is what turns the lights on for a team. Recognition of the ability with respect to the results, mutual recognition of the mood, mutuality of purpose, and mutuality of values. I think those four things in a coach, when they come onto the scene, again, you know, there's a saying out there, a euphemism. We, you know, want a leader of men, a motivator. Right? We all want that. And so I broke down what that means and what are the different complexities to it. And that's what I came up with.
Those four pillars that you described are, they're the foundational ones that the exceptional coaches build off of, and they each add their own flavor to it and their own personality to it and the way they execute it. But fundamentally, they're all doing those things. And the ones that win and win a lot are committed almost maniacally to doing those on a consistent basis year in and year out.
I would agree. And I think it was this weekend, we had the privilege of seeing some of the best, you know, some of the best in the business, you know, at work with it. We talked about Andy Reid, obviously. I think he's been extraordinary at all those for years, and he's kept at it tirelessly to get to the point where he can be the reason why teams are able to navigate these situations with such grace. Shanahan, I mean, he's beaten the Rams six times in a row with an inferior quarterback.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
He owns.
Wouldn't it be insane if the January of last year, McVay was in Cabo where he saw Matthew Stafford, and he called the Rams GM and he was like, we got to get this guy. And part of the reason why is Kyle Shanahan's here too. And if he sees this guy, he's going to try to get him too. And wouldn't it be insane if they lost to Kyle Shanahan anyway? Oh man, that's my horse from here on out. I know it's crazy to say that as a Giants fan for the 49ers, but I love the way they're built. Debo Samuel, South Carolina kid. He's the man. He's a tank.
He really is. He makes no sense as a human.
He's a tank. And he fundamentally changes the way that teams have to defend the 49ers, because if he's on the field, you need to do one of two things. Bring on a corner to respect the fact that he's a full-on wide receiver that can run routes. Or play zone. You have no other option.
Yeah, you can't bring on a big thumping linebacker to take him out because he's too fast.
Right. If you say, yeah, we're going to run man coverage, and you put a linebacker or a safety on him, you're done. That run he had against Dallas, he made one cut, 22-yard touchdown. I don't even think he was touched. And I'm like, as a Giants fan, I'm like, man, our running back don't have that type of vision, and he's not even a running back. Yeah, he's Debo is – I love his social media handle too, his 19 problems.
So who do you predict will win this weekend?
Kansas City and San Francisco.
Wow.
That's what I think. Yeah, I think that San Fran is in a better place emotionally coming off their win. I think the Rams got the bejesus scared out of them in that last game and are emotionally drained. I think the Rams, man, they know they can beat LA. They've done it 6 times in a row, including to get into the playoffs when they came down from 17 down in the second half in week 18. They just did it. And talk about fear, the Rams are already afraid. They're blocking anybody outside LA County from buying a ticket to the game.
Yeah, that's a bad look.
Your billing address has to be in LA County to buy a ticket to that game. Because they're afraid of the 49ers fans coming in. I like them. And then the Chiefs, man, I just think. Talk about the inexperience of the Bills. The Bengals are going to be out of their skis in that situation.
I don't know, man. I think the Bengals, to me, remind me of a team that's just so overconfident that they might just do it. You know, and they have something that, you know, Burrow and Chase together are unbelievable. Yeah. And
they're going to make it interesting, but I think the Chiefs will win.
Yeah. I'm hoping that the Chiefs learn their lesson from the last time they played the Bengals. Because I would, you know, the AFC North fan in me doesn't want to see the Bengals go to the Super Bowl, but I do like them as a team. I think it's going to be Chiefs and Rams. Mainly because I believe that it's a toss-up, and I don't think the 49ers defense is going to be able to stop the Rams offense this time.
That is if they ever get on the field. Because the 49ers can eat up that clock like it's nobody's business.
So the other element of it is that say what you will about how good the 49ers running game is and how they can dominate a game, but if Garoppolo can't give them, you know, 200 yards, I don't know how they do it. Like, cause Garoppolo has been horrendous. Like he's been so bad. And I have watched this all season with the Browns and Baker Mayfield. Like, when your quarterback is not threatening and you play a great defense that can put pressure on said quarterback, that's a recipe for a bad outcome.
I think Shanahan will put in Trey Lance at some point in the game.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he will use him, I think.
What for?
And I'm going to put it on record. Short yardage situation. Around midfield, but he's going to have a bomb it.
Okay. We'll see.
Or red zone, because if you put him in there with Debo in the backfield, it's impossible to stop that because both of them could run it.
Trey Lance isn't that great of a runner. He's not as good in the NFL as he was in college.
He's not. It's just the extra element of
what can happen.
Yeah, I think that Shanahan is totally ready to just do it to McVay again. That's what I think. That's what I think. Stafford also played, I think, above his level against the Bucs. He's got a mistake in him too. Just like we talk about Jimmy G, Stafford's got a mistake in him.
We'll see.
Yeah. All right, my friend. I'm looking forward to Championship Sunday. And if you're looking forward to more Mentality Monsters, which you have every reason to do, please like and subscribe. iTunes, Spotify, that's where you can find us. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, all.